such that people will come.
Oh, okay. Books and Company, huh? That's a yeah. Nice shop. Have you been there before?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've read there once before. I'm reading tonight.
I looked around. I've noticed that you cannot go out and just buy a book. I look for your book, poems, The Hundreds of Fireflies. I went to the Gotham. I went to the Phoenix. And I just couldn't find it.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I'd like to think.
I looked.
Yes.
I looked. I didn't want to read it because I admired Equal Distance so much, and I didn't want to read those poems. Uh-huh. But poetry is really tough if you just cannot find
it
in stock.
You go
and find Wordsworth or Longfellow usually.
No. But you're right. It is hard to find. And
who published it?
I don't know. The Knopf also. But no, that's one of the things that's kind of fun with publishing a novel instead of a book of poems is that you do feel in some peripheral way, but you're. I mean, you are in the stores, and one of the disappointments with publishing a book of poems is you'd have a friend in, you know, some out-of-the-way place of the country, and he'd have to, you know, he couldn't find it. He had to order it ahead. And you would like to feel that in some way it has entered into the commerce of the country in some tiny way. And with a novel, I think you're more apt to feel that. The advantage with poetry is that if the book does get in the store, it'll stay in the, you know, they don't have that thing that they do with novels where they give them a few weeks and they yank them.
3 months, I think.
Yeah.
The average store life.
Yeah, it's short. And with poetry, that's...
I say 3 weeks, 3 months.
Yeah. And with poetry, that's not true. I mean, you'll if the book, you know, they don't usually bother. I mean, they'll sit there for a while. You'll find if you go into a good bookstore that carries poetry, they'll have, you know, books that have been sitting on the shelf for, you know, years. I mean, and often I'm the eventual purchaser of those books. So you're kind of happy that they do sit there.
When you go to Books and Company tonight, will you tell them to please stock your book of poetry?
Yeah. Well, they have in the past. I haven't been in you know, this trip, but and they may have sold out. I don't know. And one of the other nice things about
What you should have done if you weren't certain about that, you probably should have. Bug them a little bit to make sure you had some copies of that.
Well,
there.
Theoretically, they have. I mean, the people at Knopf have done that. And I was actually kind of insistent. What I said was that not only did I wanted them to carry some books of poems, but I wanted some hardcovers because the trouble with the poetry, they don't reorder hard. They reorder paperback. And I like the idea of the keeping the hardcover in print, which Knopf is doing. And the poetry was reprinted both in. Hardcover and paper, and but
has it come out in subsequent editions?
The second printing
of poetry
was second printed in both.
That's rare for poetry.
It did.
Usually, you'll find the first printing of a book. I bought. I had Allen Ginsberg in a couple of weeks ago, and I went over to B. Dalton, and I just thought maybe I'd pick up a couple of. I had his collected big book of collected poems, but I thought it'd be nice to have a couple of his other books of poems and ask him to sign them for me. Mm-hmm. And there was a copy of The Iron Horse by Ginsberg that was printed in the City Lights edition in 1974. And it was a first printing. Well, it was the first American printing. It had come out 2 years previously in Canada. But isn't that unusual? I mean, here's printing in 1974.
They will sit there, and that's nice with poetry. I mean,
not for the poet.
Well, it's nice that, I mean, that you do like to think that the book has a longer shelf life than, you know, and I mean, obviously every poet would like to think that you're selling a lot of books and they keep moving, but it's just nice to feel that they do stay in the stores longer. And, I don't know. This is now, is that a first printing or is that?
Well, I hope it's the first. Usually,
seconds are just in, but I just wondered if that's.
Oh, it's terrific. Second printing. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Are you teaching in Amherst?
I'm the visiting writer in Amherst, that's right.
It's a one-year
appointment.
At
Amherst College.
Is in the University of Massachusetts there, too?
Yeah, and is known as the university, to distinguish it from Amherst College. My wife is teaching at Mount Holyoke, so. Which is just down the road. We're in the community of 5 colleges, so it works pretty well. And I've lived for years in Massachusetts. I was a student I did my undergraduate studies at Harvard, and then I went to Harvard Law School. So I was in Boston for years and years. But I had no sense of what Western Massachusetts was all about, and so that was all kind of new. You know, I used to just drive by on the way from Massachusetts to Detroit, which is where I'm from.
Well, in some respects, I can remember the names of all of your writers, all of your characters. Your hero, Danny, parallels your life, except he went to the University of Michigan.
Yes, yeah. No, I was kind of having fun playing with certain things. And it was just also, it was just easier, certain aspects of my life. It was easier as well to not have to, I mean, it's stuff I knew about. I knew a little bit about Harvard Law School, having gone there. I didn't know anything about Yale, say, so it was easy to use, you know, places I knew. But I also had fun with the characters, because I think they're composites of, I mean, partly just pure fiction and partly of various friends of mine, and I tell each of my friends that the character is completely based on him alone, and so it's kind of...
That's not necessarily flattering,
no.
Of course.
But it's fun. I mean, it's a fun kind of little joke. And
You didn't study law, did you?
Yeah, I'm a lawyer.
Was that right?
I graduated from law school in 1980 and took the Massachusetts bar. I had a very busy week, and I guess it was the end of July 1980 and the beginning of August, because I took the bar, and all within a week I took the bar and I got married, and my first book of poems was accepted. And a couple weeks after that, we moved to Japan. It was a very busy kind of time.
You didn't go there to help do research for a Japanese professor, did you?
I went there to work at something called the Kyoto Comparative Law Center, where I edited legal articles that were commercial articles. And then I also worked one day a week in a big Japanese import-export company, and which was strange.
You've never been a practicing lawyer, have you?
No. I worked the summer, after my second year, I worked on Wall Street with one of the firm that was I liked, and then did this legal research for 3 years. And then in 83, I got this MacArthur Award. I don't know if you know what that is, but this was this 5-year fellowship to sort of pursue whatever I wanted. And
yeah, that does that have a sliding scale in terms of its endowment?
If you're younger, you get less money. So in that sense,
can you tell me how much it is?
Mine was $160,000 over five. It's 30
spread over 5 years.
Yeah, 30. It was roughly my age every year times 1,000. And it was one of the few times in my life that it was wonderful and liberating and heartening and all those things. But one of the nicest things about getting it was one of the few times when I felt I wanted to be older. I would have got my money, you know.
It's better to forfeit the money. Yes. You did all right. That you have to have talent for that too. So that must have been extremely flattering.
Oh, it felt good. I mean, I think it kind of fulfilled a fantasy that most people have, or many people have, that perfect strangers out there are sort of watching you in a beneficent sort of way and are preparing to do nice things for you. Because I had no idea I was being considered. I just got a letter, Federal Express package, and they said I had won this fellowship and that I would be receiving payments for the next 5 years. And
I think Raymond Carver won one of those, didn't he?
He won something
else.
Strauss? He won, yeah.
I get those two mixed up because they're very similar.
Yeah, it's about the same amount of money, yeah. No, I don't... as far as writers who've won them, William Kennedy... One who wrote this, that Albany trilogy, and a number of, and not many fiction writers, a number of poets like Robert Penn Warren and some other people, Joseph Brodsky. But it was, you know, as I say, it came out of the blue. And
but
things
you did
like
some
that.
Celebrating that night. Huh?
Yes, well, things like that. My wife was in Japan. I was in the States at the time, and I was visiting and looking for a job, and we were broke, and she was pregnant, and so it came at a very good time, yeah.
Is your wife Japanese?
No, she is. We met at Harvard at a party in 1974 and got married just before we took off for Japan. And she has just published a book of poems with Knopf also, many of which are set in Japan. So she and I think, both profited from living overseas, but
it's just as well that you haven't really practiced law, because there aren't very many lawyers who are writers outside of Louis Auchincloss that I can think of.
He comes to mind, and I think
they don't have time.
Yeah,
and their interests are move into different areas.
Well, I think the time thing is maybe the main thing. I enjoyed, you know, the summer I worked on Wall Street, and I mean, I do like, I'm one of those people. I like going to work. I like looking for my keys in the morning and getting nervous and wondering whether the car will start and all those sorts of things. The problem for me is that writing, I'm a slow writer and I make a lot of mistakes writing, and it takes an awful lot of sitting, you know, and looking at the wall. And so there's, if I'm working, you know, full time, it's hard for me. I need big blocks of time to write in. And the summer I worked on Wall Street, I found I could do some poetry when I was there, but it was very hard to work on fiction, which for me anyway requires bigger blocks of time.
And I would also assume that there, when you write fiction, there is a momentum involved here, and if you have to interrupt it repeatedly or confine it into small periods of time, it must be more difficult. A lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
They write an hour or two before they go to work,
yes,
or on the
weekend. People who are, I think, have a better sense of, I don't know, discipline is not quite the right word, but some people, I think, are better at kind of directing their mind to do what they want it to do than I am. And for me, writing is it's a very frustrating thing. It's very inefficient. But it ultimately is quite satisfying, but it does seem to require, especially working on a big project like a novel, it requires hours and hours of sitting around and feeling sorry for yourself. And so I did find with poems, one of the nice things is that I really can work on poems while riding on the subway, or, I mean, you can 20 minutes here and a half an hour here, and I don't always do that, but, and often I spend 2 or 3 hours sitting in an office or something. But that summer I worked in New York, I would take my poems with me, and I'd look at them at various times in the day when I felt I had half an hour or something like that.
Of course, it's going to take another MacArthur Award or two if you can finance a career as a poet.
Yes, that's one of the great problems with it. It's also, as is true with most things about poetry, it has its advantages. I mean, one of the nice things about being a poet is that you don't, with very, very few exceptions, nobody really makes any money as a poet, and so that you don't even really worry about things like sales very much. I mean, we're talking about such small figures to begin with that it doesn't much matter, you know, and you're obviously doing it for other things. There's no way you can really sell out as a poet. I mean, even if you were to try to prostitute your talents, I don't think there'd be any buyers, you know. I mean, it's whereas with fiction, there are various ways that you can get into things that are artistically invalid but maybe profitable, and that's just not true with poetry. So that there's a nice kind of purity to writing poetry, and the sense of being so absolutely peripheral and distant and so far away from the cultural center of things. It has its appeals too, I think.
How long did you live in Japan?
On and off for 3 years, so we were there long enough to begin to be quite frustrated by certain things, and the novelty wears off. And I know, for example, we had no bath or shower, which is common in Japan. You'd have to go to the public baths, which would seem very kind of colorful and interesting your first couple of months there, and you know, you feel that you were partaking of some authentic Japanese experience. But within a few months, it becomes quite inconvenient, and it's cold, and you don't want to walk over to the public bath and walk back. And that is in miniature a kind of example of what it was like being there. I mean, there were things that got on our nerves after a while, and there were other things that seemed prettier and more interesting in the third year than they did in the first.
Well, in reading Equal Distance, I learned a lot about modern Japan. I don't think there are too many books that express what a Westerner's life would be like living in such a foreign culture. And you do a nice job in explaining that. One of the things I noticed, for example, in addition to some of the physical problems, such as the bath and everything, was that Westerners... No, I don't know if you did this simply to make it more simple for the book, but it seems to me that Westerners are isolated to an extreme degree. Danny and the rest had only a couple of Japanese friends. Otherwise, they seem to associate among themselves.
Yes. No, that can be true, and that was one of the things that in my book I did want to show. It's also true that the strange thing about being in Japan, say, is that you are so immediately perceived as a foreigner. I mean, it's not a case. If I were to go to France, I mean, when I open my mouth, people will realize that I'm not French. But I can sort of walk up and down the street, and maybe maybe I could fool someone that I'm a French person. And you know, in Japan, I mean, from a distance, hundreds of yards off, as you're walking down the street, they are perceiving you as a foreigner, so that your sense of being distanced from everything is so enhanced. You know, you get onto a bus and you see instantly whether you are or are not the only Westerner aboard. I mean, I don't mean after a while you're not even filtering this information through your mind in any kind of conscious way, but it's there. I mean, that sense of everyone seeing you and perceiving you as someone different. And so I think
that doesn't happen to that degree in the United States, because, except perhaps in maybe very isolated communities, mm-hmm. but in the United States we have television anchor mm-hmm. people who are Oriental, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you walk on the streets of the big urban centers, particularly New York, you yes. see crowds of Oriental
yeah.
people,
yeah.
whole
yeah.
communities and neighborhoods,
yes.
every vegetable store
yes.
operated by Orientals.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's this feeling of strangeness that foreign Orientals would have, because their skin and,
yes.
and physical makeup is different.
I think to some extent, yeah, that is true. The interesting thing about Japan is it is so homogeneous, and there are such, I mean, there are little pockets of minorities, but there are little, these pockets. I mean, the people, here's a country of 120 million people where they all have the same hair color, and they all have, you know, I mean, it's a kind of homogeneity that is very strange. I mean, for us to even kind of think of, it's even in a small town in the United States, you would never have quite that lack of racial diversity. I mean, even in your small town, you've got people who come from, some originally came from Ireland, and some came from France, and, you know, some came from Germany, and some from Scandinavia, and there isn't that sense of, I mean, of being all one group and other people being so clearly not members of that group.
Well, there is, I don't know if I can find it, but there is one very interesting passage that followed the chapter in which Danny had an encounter, I don't know whether it was lunch or dinner, with the professor,
mm-hmm.
and which you allude to. Equal distance, and I can't. Do you remember where that is? Remember
yeah.
the part I'm talking about?
I think so.
I'm not sure. I don't want to have to leave through. Spend time leaping through there.
Uh-huh.
But I think that really summarized what you meant by equal distance to a degree. Maybe you can tell
yes,
me.
Yes, I think we are right in here. But this is a part of the book where the
yeah here it is. The distance yes. was simply too vast, like an insect under a microscope. And he was caught. Etc. Tell me a little bit about that.
Uh-huh. Well, that little part of the book, I was having fun. What I had done was I like putting little anecdotes that involve my friends in the novel, and the Japanese professor, in his fastidious way, is talking about watching someone eat 17 steaks in an all-you-can-eat steakhouse in Newton, Massachusetts, which a friend of mine was the one who had done that and had broken the house record and had eaten all the steaks, so he has a small cameo role in the book. But, what the scene is supposed to evoke, or what I would hope it would evoke, is a sense of kind of misunderstanding on both sides, and the sense that the, in this very small but basic way of how you eat, the American didn't quite understand the Japanese people, and the Japanese didn't understand the American. And the American, this really is autobiographical, but I was kind of horrified at these Japanese people who would eat so loudly and slurp their food, which I was told since I was 2 years old is rude. And of course, they were always horrified at, you know, my own table manners, I'm sure. So I was kind of having fun playing with this, the gulf, and suggesting that, it's a pessimistic moment in the book, and I don't think it's maybe representative of the whole tone of the book. But in that moment, anyway, it does seem that, east is east and west is west. I mean, that there is this gap that you can't bridge, and you can't even sit down and explain to each other in your broken English or whatever what you don't understand or what seems unappealing or anything like that. That there's a level of politeness that kind of intervenes and keeps you.
I hope that. Greg, I have trouble remembering the names of characters when they're not my own. But I hope that while you say you have made, I think you used the term montage or composite of, of some of your friends, but I hope that while there were some likable things about Greg, ultimately I think he was unlikable, and I hope that you really didn't have a friend to the unlikability to that degree.
Well, maybe I did. I don't know. I admit him to be... likeable. He was the character I most...
At first, after a while, he gets on your nerves.
Yes, well, he's...
This constant
rambling on.
After a while, you want to walk away from it.
Yes, no, he's meant to be exasperating, and I had hoped sufficiently endearing that, you know, one kind of puts up with his exasperatingness. But one of the, as I rewrote, I mean, one of the things I was trying, you know, deliberately trying to do in successive drafts was to make him... increasingly to make him a little more irritating and to draw the contrast. Well, I'm glad to hear that, but he was also, it was the character I had most fun writing about. I mean, as I would sit down and I'd realize I had three or four pages where he was going to play a major role. It was fun for me. The sense of hyperbole and the loose associations by which he would move from point A to point X, and you wouldn't quite understand how you got from there to there. All that kind of thing, and it was, by way of contrast with the rest of the book, was a pleasure to write anyway. I do hope it exasperates readers and stuff. I hope not so much that they want to put the book down.
Oh no, doesn't happen that way. What I meant was that it strikes a chord.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you have to have that. You have to, a reader must feel something for the character. Mm-hmm. I think he should feel rage or sympathy or understanding or something.
Yes.
If you don't do that, then there...
Yes.
For example, Carrie. I didn't like Carrie. There was something too aloof and non-sympathetic about her. She didn't really seem to care about anybody around her. And I think you did a nice job in... separating these three characters because you gave them very uniquely distinct personalities.
Well, one of the things, and I'm generalizing on the basis of one book, which is dangerous, but just with my own experience with writing and rewriting, one of the things that one does is as you go along, you get sort of fond of your characters, and there's a tendency to want to protect them and make them less unappealing or less irritating. And I was constantly trying to have to make with each of my characters, I was there was a tendency to kind of make them, you know, either less stupid or less or whatever their faults were. And so you're constantly kind of going through and trying to rein in that impulse. And instead, I think they come most alive in their kind of faults and foibles and things. And so, you know, as you go along, and you have I have this main character, Danny, and he was constantly doing embarrassing things, and I'd get kind of protective, and I'd want to take them out. And in fact, I think that's what, or at least I would like to think, that's what sort of gives the book life. And you have another character who talks too much and rambles and raves, and one would self-protectively or kind of want to edit that. And I would, you know, have to think, no, this is what gives him life, and I'll leave it that way. And similarly with Carrie, I mean, there was a tendency where a feeling I had of trying to make her less aloof and warmer and more appealing, but that wasn't what I at least I don't think that's what I needed. And so, again, I had to kind of check that impulse to make everybody sort of blandly sweet, and which, you know, was maybe that makes them all more likable, but I think ultimately it makes the book a lot more boring. And
One of the very best chapters was the one, the final chapter with Dad and Saipan. If I had a nitpick, I think I would have moved that chapter up. Because in a way, the chapter is so good that it could almost stand on its own as a separate story. Has it been published as a separate story?
No, it was fun. It was the thing that I did.
I would like to, because it was so well done and so different from the rest.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
I would like to, if you'd moved it inward a little more so that it would be surrounded a little more by something.
Yeah.
That's a nitpicking thing that has nothing to do with the quality at all.
Yeah.
Because it was a wonderful, wonderful
Oh, thank you. Well, it was fun. I switched tenses. I moved into the present tense in the last part. And what I wanted to do in a book which had been full of a lot of internal, a lot of the action is internal and it's people's reflections and whatnot. And I wanted to move into a section, and in part the switch to present tense was to indicate this, that was more action, real action. I mean, people hitting tennis balls and people swimming in the water and people driving up and down Saipan and looking at flame trees and all this. So that I wanted to get away from all of this endless kind of, thinking and rethinking and into a realm of, of a simple kind of world where there's a hot sun and there's a blue sea and there's...
But you also changed the perspective because throughout Equal Distance, the perspective was from Danny's, and in that last chapter, a great deal of that chapter was through the father's perspective.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you had a change. It was almost as though you were writing something different. You were writing something different, I think.
Yes. No, I think that's right. I mean, I did want... I wanted to suggest, in a way, relieving a certain kind of claustrophobia, because I've got a book that, for the most part, you really do see everything through one character's eyes, and that was another pleasure to writing the fourth part, is all of a sudden the observer is the observed, and the character who's been seeing everything is now being kind of commented on, and so you, as the author, you can then say certain things to the reader that you haven't been able to say up until this point, and kind of comment in what I hope would be in a wry or ironic way about what it's like, what it's like to be with this person as an outsider. And so, no, it was, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that it was meant to be different, and I think that was one of the reasons why it was so much fun to, as I'd be writing, say I'm writing the third draft, and when I'd get to part four, all of a sudden my energy would sort of pick up and in that hot sun and everything else. And
is that where you wrote it, in that hot sun?
No, I did go out to Saipan, and it was, I had kind of conceived it all before I ever got there, and then got out there and changed things, because there was, and added things, I mean, there was all sorts of things on Saipan I didn't expect to find there, but I did want, from very early on, I wanted to have a character going back, a father going back to look where he fought in the war, and that was a good place. And it was fun. I mean, I liked it.
Well, if there were any poor reviews, the publisher did not. They usually Xerox background, and I didn't see any at all. But you must be very pleased with the critical reception to the book.
Yes, I have been. It's been working out well, and one doesn't know. I also, as I said, I write poems, and with poems, you get, I hate to use the word feedback, but I'll use it for the moment, but you do get little responses to things. You write a poem, and it appears in a magazine, and someone sees it and says they liked it. But with the novel, you don't have that sense of incremental progress. I mean, really what happens is this big manuscript one day appears, and you don't really know what people are going to think, and I've worked on the book on and off, but it was the big thing in my life for close to 4 years, and in that amount of time, you completely lose any perspective on it, and I think any kind of sense of confidence about what it's like to view it as an outsider, because you're so immersed in it, it's hard to kind of step back. So I was very pleasantly surprised that when the reviews started to come out, and there have been
a terrific start. How old are you?
I'm 32 tomorrow.
32. Well, happy birthday!
Thank you.
I can't think of a better a birthday present for you than to have a second printing of Equal Distance. And
well, I'm hoping there'll be a third, but I don't know if that's kind of
don't all writers.
Yes,
most are happy to get a second.
Yes, no, I don't know. I think they're. Let me optimistically say how. Predictions like this shouldn't be made because one regrets them later. But I do think there will be, and I hope there will be.
Are you still visiting Japan on any regularity?
No, I want to get back, and I haven't been for really a year and a half or so. And I would like to. It's gotten harder now that we've got the baby. Just it's a long flight, and it's And emotionally, I think it's a little hard to...
Besides, you're tired of having to go to the bathhouse to get washed.
Yeah, no, there's all kind. There really are all kinds of problems involved about going back. And but I do. I very much want to. We are going to move overseas after this year, after the school year.
Have so. You decided where you're going?
Probably to Italy. I don't know. I
just for the different
environment. Well, I like living. Yeah, I want to get back. I've taken a little Italian and have forgotten every word of it, and I want to get back to that. And,
are you writing something new now?
Well, I'm. Turning in a second book of poems within the next month or two, and I've started in a very sketchy way a second novel. And then I'm doing some journal, you know, I do reviews and things, and but mostly, and then trying to wind up teaching. But the main thing will be to get really, really going on the second novel. And I think
it's not set in Japan, is it?
No, it will be set, for the most part, I think, in Boston, so. At least that's the way it looks now. I don't know. I will probably try to spend 2 years over there. It's a good. I want to get over there before we have to start worrying about the baby and her schooling and all the rest. So,
well, Brad Lighthouser, I want to make sure I'm pronouncing your right, your name right. It's Lighthouser.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I imagine you get Lighthouser.
Yeah, I get all sorts of things.
As I do. So I want to make sure that I have it. It's a embarrassing to go on the air, and all of a sudden I realize here I've been talking to someone, and I forgot to double-check the pronunciation name, so it's Brad Lighthouser. It was a wonderful first novel, Brad, and thank you very much for coming and talking to me. I hope that as subsequent publications come out, you'll consider coming back, and we'll talk more.
Oh, thank you.